Hello all, and welcome to yet another fascinating installation of The Partial Historians.
Woohoo!
I am Dr. Radford.
And I'm Dr. Greenfield.
And we apologise in advance if our voices sound funny or if you hear any strange noises. We're both extremely ill.
Yeah, I'm hoping to emulate a husky tone by the end of this episode.
That's right. Now, we have rather an exciting topic today because we are actually doing a topic within our topic.
Ooh, I feel like I should add some sort of sound effect at this point.
I know, right?
Ta-da!
Yeah. So we're going to be looking at the Roman emperors for the next little while, actually.
I hear you cheer.
Exactly. So, of course, we are going to be looking at their sex lives because that's freakishly fascinating.
Well, it seems to be the direction that we've headed off on, and we seem to be on this trajectory now where we're like, no, we won't be satisfied until we've done the sex of everybody that we've come across. But in order to sort of set that whole scenario up, to appreciate some of the sex lives that we're going to be discussing, we've decided that it'd probably be useful as an introduction to sort of get a handle on who the person is that we're dealing with, what their career was like.
Exactly.
What we can say about them in sort of broader terms.
Yes.
And then hone in on the sexuality later on.
So we are going to be starting with Augustus, who is, I should warn you, dear listeners, one of Miss Greenfield over here's favourite emperors ever.
I only have a small crush, but it is a significant crush, and he's a man of such power. I'm not quite sure how.
It's the protestants that gets you, isn't it? The autoritas.
He is the ultimate pater familias.
Well, he is, and that's actually probably a good point to start on. The fact that, unusually, I suppose, for most emperors, Augustus ruled for a very long time. Like, he's around for a significant chunk of time.
Yeah, talk about getting them off to a flying start.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, he's in power effectively from about 31 BC up until his death in 14 AD.
And he was around on the political scene before that, of course. So it was just that he wasn't in sort of power.
He wasn't in a sort of a position of absolute power.
Yes.
And arguably, you could say he wasn't really in a position of thorough absolute power in 31 BC either, but it was pretty clear that he was...
He was the last man standing.
Yeah, yeah. He kind of won.
To give you an idea of who he actually is, I suppose, we might want to delve into his family history a little bit. He is the great-nephew of none other than Julius Caesar.
And I don't know, we haven't done an episode of Julius Caesar, we'll come back to him. He's not very significant in Roman history.
Right? That's right. Who cares about Julius Caesar?
What did he ever do for the Romans?
What did he do for the Romans, indeed?
Yeah, exactly.
And so, yeah, so Augustus is his great-nephew. So he is...
It's a tenuous connection, isn't it?
It is, a little bit. It's kind of surprising. But there is a contact between them, obviously. It's not just, you know...
Sexual.
Yeah. Well, that we'll get to that. Don't you remember that? But yes. So he is the great-nephew of Julius Caesar. And as such, because Julius Caesar himself struggled to have a son or an heir...
Yeah, I mean, Julius Caesar, for all of his achievements, ends up being... childless, effectively, towards the end of his life, and his way of dealing with this is a fairly standard and traditional method of the Romans, which is to adopt.
Yes.
And adoption sort of stands in a much more significant way than adoption does today, in the sense that it was considered a complete transference, even to the point at which, you know, you were no longer part of the previous family. Except through your history, obviously.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's obviously all well and good on paper, but I'm sure in practical terms there was probably still some contact between... I mean, we know that Augustus, for example, or Octavian, as some might know him, certainly maintained ties with his sister.
Yeah, well, I suppose we should clarify that as well. Is that the man that we know as Augustus... Mm. Goes by many names.
Yes, he was not born Augustus.
No, this is something that happens to him quite later on in his career. So when we first pick up him in his life, he's known as Octavian. And this is a nod to his father's side of the family, which is not the name that he uses eventually, because once he becomes the son of Julius Caesar, he becomes himself, Julius Caesar.
Yes, because you have to, when you're adopted, you then take on the name of the clan, etc., that you are adopted into. So he becomes a Julius Caesar himself, but with the addition of Octavianus, of course.
So that people
know where he strings from.
Yeah, so what tends to happen is, in sort of Roman nomenclature, he'd be Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus, and the Anus ending representing that that was his original family.
Yes.
He never used Octavianus as far as we know.
Use it.
we use it to help us distinguish between the period when he was of one family and then he was adopted into another family.
Yes. And then, yeah, later on in life, the Senate apparently just begged him to take the title of Augustus. Because Augustus it has a special meaning, does it not?
Augeo, to elevate, to rise up in various ways.
Mm. And and that's where we get the month August from, people. It was named after him, apparently. apparently.
I don't really have anything to add to that. I'm like, obviously?
Well, obviously to us. Who the hell knows where these names come from? So you got July after Julius Caesar and August after Augustus. And then, of course, my favourite emperor, Tiberius, who succeeds Augustus, refuses to have a month named after him because he's far too modest for that sort of rubbish.
And you were always thinking September was definitely named after Tiberius. There's got to be a logical connection in there somewhere.
Anyway, back on track. Yes. So he comes along and basically... Once Julius Caesar is assassinated, you might think, because Octavian was only, 18, if I recall
18,
correctly? 19. Yeah, quite young in Roman political terms.
Yeah, certainly not old enough to hold any official political position, usually the age of sort of 25.
Yeah, the minimum. Yeah. I mean, obviously you have had people coming along like Pompey who sort of smashed those barriers down a little bit, but he was still regarded as a freak.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, people who have come before Octavian / Augustus and held political position in younger years have been seen as sort of trailblazers and people who are operating as rogues, essentially.
Exactly.
Outside the system.
It's not the norm.
Way.
It's certainly not the norm.
Definitely not normal.
No. But he essentially... You know, it could have been the end of his political career with Julius Caesar dying because, obviously, there goes his connection. And even though he has the name, what is in a name? Yeah. What is in a name?
Good luck to you, sonny boy. It turns out that you've got a lot of enemies because now you're the son of the guy we've just murdered.
That's right, we stabbed to death multiple times. But it's not the end of him. In spite of the fact that he is obviously in a fairly precarious political position and also seems to have rather poor health... Just add icing on the cake. Mm. He gets through. He does.
And he sort of does it in the face of criticism and objection. Once he hears about Julius Caesar being assassinated, he immediately starts to make his way back to Rome. He makes the journey back because he's not in Italy at the time. He's just on the other side of the Adriatic. And he makes it back really quickly, as far as we can tell from all of the narratives. Much faster than anybody in Rome is anticipating.
Yes.
And he gets there and starts sort of demanding justice for the murder of his father.
Yes.
And nobody really is expecting this. And he's a fresh-faced boy. He's quite young. I mean, they've seen him a few times. They know of his association with Caesar. But nobody's really expecting this. This is something that...
Yes, because actually, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but off the top of my head, I'm remembering that Julius Caesar sort of adopted him in his will, not before...
Yeah, and this is one of these sort of age-old controversies of...
Was he adopted, or was it just heir? Was he just heir?
Yeah, what was the exact wording in the document? And people have argued about the various interpretations for that. And then again, to what extent was he aware that this was something that was going to happen?
Exactly.
And... You have to assume, given how fast he moves, that
he was reasonably aware.
He knew.
Yes. And he was obviously making them. I mean, regardless of whether Julius Caesar did or did not adopt him in his will, he was obviously going to make the most of the connection and the power vacuum left.
Yeah. I mean, what do you do in this scenario? I mean, his mother tried to dissuade him, as far as we can tell. Some of the source material suggests that she and her husband, not his father, a different husband, had objections and were like, you know, this is not worth it. Don't run into this sort of mess. This is a minefield. You don't want to go there.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, this is what I need to do.
Sure.
It's important. I have to show... pietas to my father,
yes,
a piety, and I suppose
this is a classic example of why I find Augustus slightly off-putting, and you probably love him, because he's very good at putting on a good public face and saying all the right things, but
you've got
to secretly,
love a man who's good with his words.
Yeah, but secretly deep down, he's a ruthless little opportunist.
As becomes very clear in the next sort of 5-year period.
Yeah. because this young, fresh-faced boy, essentially, manages to weasel his way into the heart of Roman politics.
Mm.
And they essentially let him in probably almost because he's so young and inexperienced. I mean, even though obviously he's not completely new to the political scene, but he is inexperienced.
I think some people are hoping that he'll fall over publicly and this will be the end of it.
Yeah, and you have people like Cicero who are willing to use him initially as a weapon to get rid of Mark Antony, who is, of course, the other man who sees himself as sort of Caesar's heir in a sense.
Yeah, so we've essentially got a situation that develops in the wake of Caesar's assassination where you have...
The assassins have scattered. They had no plan, it seems. Really bright guys.
They've gone WTF out of here.
Yeah. Oh my God. The people are turning on us.
Yeah. How is this even possible? I need to retreat just to consider what I'm going to do next.
Yes, I need to gather my thoughts away from Rome.
Yeah. So the lead conspirators, they hightail it out of there quick time. And you're left with Octavian, who says, I have a legitimate claim as the son of Caesar to demand justice for his murder.
Yep.
And on the other hand, you have Mark Antony, who is one of the senior generals of Caesar, who says, well, I'm really the guy that he's been grooming all of these years to take over his position.
Yes.
Now that Caesar is gone, it is my time.
And Mark Antony is legendarily... Is that a word? Legend. Anyway, I'm sick.
Legendarily.
Yeah, it's going to be a word while I'm sick. Yeah, he is notably, I suppose, the person who gave Caesar's funeral oration and got the crowd all psyched up for revenge after Caesar's assassination.
Definitely.
And he is of the right age and experience. You know, he's not a fresh-faced boy. He is definitely a man.
Yeah. So it's like I've got a mature general who's been waiting in the wings, and then we've got this young upstart who doesn't have sort of any experience whatsoever of almost anything, and all of a sudden they're at loggerheads over who is going to be the person who is the ultimate heir to Caesar.
Yes, and not to get too bogged down in the civil wars that follow, but essentially they do sort of do a tap dance of Mark Antony and Octavian uniting together to, you know, put the assassins down, and then they have falling outs and they don't like each other very much, and, you know, then you have people like Cicero who's, you know, I don't know what he's trying to do.
Well, I mean, it definitely becomes a situation where there's a lot of squabbling involved, and obviously the priority turns out to be going after the conspirators.
Yes.
And it's in Antony and Octavian's interest to band together for that one.
Yes. And they do.
And they make a lot of money out of that because they go through a whole prescription process as well where they track down people who they designate as being enemies, and then they confiscate all their goods and they're like, oh, well, look what I have in my coffers.
Look at this list of 300 names. all of them wealthy, of course.
How did you end up on the list?
Exactly. You must have done something wrong to end up on the list.
Yeah. So, I mean, we basically have a state where these guys start terrorizing the upper echelons of Roman society for their own benefit.
See? Ruthless. I'm
an opportunist.
Where did he get such a taste for blood?
I don't know. Maybe he stabbed flies.
so they do this. They do this thing. They put down the assassins. They defeat Brutus and Cassius and all.
And then when there's nobody left, they turn on themselves.
Of course.
Turn on each other.
Yes, and I mean, you know, there is obviously another man who's also sort of part of this Lepidus, but we won't go into that too much because it's kind of a bit of a sideline. But essentially, to everyone's amazement, Octavian is left as one of the two men standing. And obviously it goes into a showdown between Mark Antony and Octavian.
Yeah. So to put things in just a little bit of a chronology. So we've launched from like 44, the assassination of Caesar, and now we're skipping over what is 36 BC, which is when the third guy in this group of men, Antony, Octavian, and Lepidus gets sidelined very early on in 36. Yes. He goes into permanent exile for the rest of his life.
Yeah, he's clearly never as much of a player as the other two.
No. Yeah. And that leaves us with Antony and Octavian
bickering
for another 5 years before we get to the Battle of Actium.
And it's of course during this period that Antony is famously having his on again off again affair with Cleopatra.
Yeah. So I mean, this is something that's taking place over the course of many years, this affair with Cleopatra.
Yes.
And
which
turns
into, quite a weapon for Octavian. Yeah. Antony running off to the east and indulging in all sorts of luxurious gettings on with this foreign queen.
Well, the Romans have this very sort of quintessential idea of themselves as upstanding moral farmers. They come from...
Yeah, right.
Well, I hear you laugh.
Yes.
But this is one of these sort of...
Of course, yeah.
You know, self conceptualizations.
Yeah,
that
and
the
it
Romans
probably was
have.
Once. It was true... Once upon a time, and it is true for certain people, but not necessarily the people who are making these judgments.
No. Look, if there's any connection between this sort of idea of the upstanding moral Roman farmer and the reality of politics in the late Republic that we're in at the moment, I mean, you know, good luck to you. But they have this ideal vision that there's an upstanding moral Roman farmer archetype that all Romans should be striving towards in some way. Mm. And
Antony is certainly not that.
Yeah, and Octavian very cleverly plays on that sort of rhetoric and propaganda to twist Antony into this figure that represents everything foreign and everything that's not Roman.
And effeminate and luxurious and, blah, blah, blah.
And look, Antony's trying to do the same thing to him. It's fair. It works both ways.
Of course.
The trouble is that we end up with the documentation
from
that,
the winner
that comes from Augustus later on. But there's definitely seeds in the source material that suggest, you know, Antony's accusing Octavian of being effeminate. There's a lot of rumors going around about that.
Yep.
And
so sex is at the heart of their.
There's a lot of mudslinging going on from both sides.
Like we've talked about before, the Romans like to go for the jugular.
Yeah.
When they're talking about enemies in a political sense. And one of the ways of attacking someone is by, bringing up the sex life and what they're getting up to.
Yeah, personally. Yeah. And we will get into in far more detail.
We're just going to swing by that.
Yeah.
So essentially it comes into a showdown at Actium.
Mm-hmm. Which is a little piece of Greece.
Yes. I think yes.
A little. Well, it's like it's kind of not really Greece. It's kind of like the shoreline of the eastern side of the Adriatic. But you know, it's sort of like we're like Dalmatia or something like that.
Yeah, and that's oh my god, my memory's failing. Is that 32 BC or is that 33 BC?
31 BC.
Okay, 31 BC. And
I feel
so,
like I should know exactly where Actium is.
Who cares?
We're anyway, ill. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So it comes down to a showdown and Octavian wins, essentially.
Yes.
Cleopatra and Antony, they're not killed in this battle. They famously
famously retreat.
Or the naval.
Thank you, Hollywood, for that singular detail.
Exactly. Anyway, and so essentially they end up not long afterwards. Antony apparently falls on his sword and Cleopatra famously commits suicide, possibly by a snake bite to the breast or some sort of poison. Yeah, very sexy. And so you have this young, he's still fairly young.
He's still young.
Basically, he's sort of the average age that someone will be starting a political career by the end of all of this.
But he's come out as the only guy left standing out of this huge civil brawl.
Now he has to sort of figure out his position, you know, like how he's going to adapt to life after war. You know, it's peace, finally. Peace.
Gets to have a bit of an existential crisis.
Who am I? Yes.
What is my role?
Yeah, and so he very cleverly, and this is the thing, I do respect Augustus, don't get me wrong. How can you not?
Here we go.
Yeah, how can you not?
But he's a survivor.
Oh, he's just too clever for my liking. He essentially starts accruing all these powers, which normally you'd only hold, you know, one at a time or one or two.
Well, look, I think at this point it's probably fair to say that there are different schools of thought on about how Octavian goes from this fresh-faced young man who ends up as the victor in Actium, and by that stage he's politically astute and he's succeeded militarily as well. How does he go from being that guy who's got all of this sort of latent power?
Yeah.
How does he go from that to legitimizing that power into some other form?
Yes,
because that's progressively what ends up happening.
Yeah, because we're talking about, I mean, in the popular mind, people might think Julius Caesar is the first emperor of Rome. Not so.
No.
He was a dictator. I mean, as in, he was made a dictator for varying periods of time, the last of which was dictator for life, which is possibly what it got him a knife in the back.
Because
the Romans don't like the idea of monarchy and anything approaching monarchy.
Yeah, there's this huge stigma historically attached to monarchy ever since they had the expulsion of the kings. And we've talked a little about Lucretia in that regard and the expulsion of the kings out of Rome. It happens very early on in their history. We're talking like 509 BC.
Yes, exactly.
They never get over it. In the same way that they have this very idolized sense of who they are as a Roman.
Yes, it's almost like they're stuck in the mindset of...
They also have very strong political ideology associated with we will not be ruled by kings.
Yeah, so now that the war is over, you know, all the civil bickering and whatever that happened after Julius Caesar's death, Octavian certainly does not want to fall into the same trap that Caesar did and attract a little bit too much attention for being essentially a king.
So you have to be slightly more subtle.
You do. And so he ends up instituting, some people would argue, what he ends up sort of instituting is a system called the Principate or the Principate, which eventually will turn into the empire.
Yeah. And this is really the key, is that it's not an easy transition from being a republic to being a Roman empire.
No, and he certainly can't just turn around and go, right, well, I've fought long and hard for the past 10 years.
I'm the only guy left.
Yep, I'm the only guy left, and so this is how it's going to work out. You guys are just going to love me. I'm going to be in power. It's all going to be awesome for the next 30 or so years.
It's never going to be that easy. And he spends the next sort of 10, 15 years really working hard to cement what will be his position.
Yeah, legitimizing his power. Yeah. Getting sort of little bits and pieces, which we don't probably need to go into the technicalities.
No, I don't think that would be particularly useful at this point. But this idea that he spends a lot of time subtly building up his position in various ways, legally and... You know, there's discussions in scholarship that, you know, he stacks the Senate in his favor, which is, you know, reasonable enough given that he's proscribed so many people. So he's gotten rid of enough people, and he's also culled numbers in the Senate, which enables him to then fill it back up with people who are going to be more favorable to his ideas.
Yes, of course. There is also the point of view that the Romans were probably legitimately sick of war.
Yeah,
by this point,
the exhaustion view certainly comes into play, because it's not the case that this is just a singular incident of civil war. Rome has really been in a state of on and off civil war ever since about 100 BC.
Yeah,
because
you've got Sulla, who, you know,
we could roll out a list of names, so it's probably not going to mean much. But from about 100 down to, 31, we've had sort of an on and off state
of civil war.
And
as well as foreign wars, of course.
It may be very well the case that the Romans were sick of it. And Augustus is the one guy who seems to have the political nous to adapt and change this system in a way that doesn't piss people off so much that they kill him.
Yeah, so he basically, instead of saying, right, I'm dictator, which would be, a way of getting solitary power... Instead of doing something like
gaining the position of dictator would be a legal way of obtaining sole rule.
Yes.
But the limitations legally on that is it's only ever for 6 months.
Yeah, it's an emergency provision. Yeah,
it's supposed to revert back to the consuls, this two men sharing power after that 6 month period. So it's not a viable option. And you've got the example of what happens to somebody if they're given the dictatorship for life.
Not very popular.
Which is quite extraordinary.
Yes.
And you get assassinated. So,
so he basically,
there's got to be another way.
He basically gradually accrues various offices, which traditionally would only be held by, one, a single person.
Yeah. Yes.
You would only hold one office at a time. But he gradually, manages to wiggle around so that the Senate says, yes, you can have these various powers, which essentially, as a whole, mean he has quite remarkable control.
Yes, yeah, but without necessarily ever actually having to hold the positions that power necessarily relates to.
He just gets to have the power.
Yeah, they do this really interesting thing where they start to divorce the powers from having to hold the position.
The actual job, yeah.
Yeah, so this is how Augustus eventually gets around it.
Yes. And then, of course, then it becomes very interesting because it is peacetime and he has quite... justifiably, I would say, earned himself quite a reputation for being a ruthless son of a bitch.
How dare you say such
things?
Yeah,
and so now that it's peacetime, it might not be in his best interest to maintain such an image, would you say?
I think the PR machine's well underway
exactly.
on this one.
Yes. So we might finish there, because that gives you a bit of a background to Augustus, the man we're going to be looking at. And we hope you join us next time when we're going to delve into his personal life.
Yeah. So now we've just sort of set up all of the conditions leading up to his sort of position of power, and we can delve into the recesses of his private life in a little bit more depth.
Until next time.
Farewell.